Do we clap at the same time? I forget.
Yes, let's clap at the same time. I don't know if this will work.
Wait, 3, 2, 1?
Yeah.
Okay.
3, 2, 1. See? Because we're each trying to sync up with the other person, and it doesn't work.
I think that was fine.
It'll be fine. I'll figure it out in the edit.
Welcome to Farced Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
Welcome back to Farced Perspective. I'm Ben, and this is my co-host, Anna.
Hey, Ben.
And today we're talking about What's Up, Doc, which celebrates its 50th anniversary on March 10th. 2022, having originally been released in 1972. Reviews that came out soon thereafter. In the New York Times, reviewer Peter Stjeldal said that the predictability of the punchlines is so uncanny, one feels oneself ready to recite along with the actors, and that he felt it was a plague of a movie. Similarly, Pauline Kael in The New Yorker said that the picture is ridiculous, noisy, and finally, depressing. And yet, this movie was chosen by the two current major critics at The New York Times as part of their quarantine watch. And when director Peter Bogdanovich died in January 2022 at the age of 82, 50 years after directing the movie, he was celebrated in part for this film, which people consider to be a landmark of slapstick. Anna, what did you think about 1972's Barbra Streisand vehicle, What's Up, Doc?
Oh, Ben, I think you know what I think, because I texted you the first time I was watching it. I couldn't believe that you made me watch this horror movie.
So, the New York Times' Peter Stjeldal basically also felt that this was monstrous. He said that all viewers should avoid the film like the plague and just wanted to list how bad the dialogue was, how flat the people were. In 1974, only a couple of years later, that does not say Sprague, so I don't know what that says. But Michael Spiroff, maybe, said that Bogdanovich had talent, but it's hollow and pointless because he reduces all characters to types and he reduces all human drama to movie cliches. Lots of people at the time that this movie came out didn't like it, except for the fact that it went on to make $70 million in the box office, surpassing the film that Streisand had made only a couple of years earlier when she, in 1970, made $29 million gross for The Owl and the Pussycat, which was considered to be a massive success. This knocked that into a cocked hat, so audiences loved it. What didn't you like about it? Was it the same thing that the critics didn't like about it, or was it something else?
Oh, where do I start?
please, pick anything.
I think what struck me first about it was that Streisand's character, Judy, really steps over the boundaries of one character after another. But it's like, first we see her doing it with Howard, where Howard is really telling her no over and over again. And she really willfully ignores him saying no.
Let me help you.
Don't help me. Just go away.
Okay.
And I think that in a different context, this is something that would come across as sort of cheeky, cute, or a trickster vibe, like the Bugs Bunny analogy I'm sure we'll get to. But in a Bugs Bunny context, it might be different with Bugs Bunny, you know, like he's fighting for his life, right? But Howard Bannister character is, you know, a stranger and picked at random for what reason we don't know. Later it comes up that he looks good in his underwear, his pajamas.
So when she first sees Howard, to help reinforce the Bugs Bunny-ness of it all, she has stolen a couple of carrot sticks off a passing tray in the lobby of the Bristol Hotel. And she's just sitting there munching on the carrot sticks. She's called room service and is basically scamming her way into a free meal by having something laid out in front of what she knows to be an empty room so that she can then go up and claim it later.
My favorite detail of the first part of like the grifter aspect of her character in that opening scene mm-hmm. is like the only redeeming part of her.
And as she's saying that she wants, I believe, hot chocolate. Anyway, she wants something warm. And she says,
and a coffee, hot fudge sundae with a large bottle of diet, anything? You got that?
As she sees Ryan O'Neill walk across the room. And, like, basically, the only thing that first draws her to him is that he's hot compared to everybody else that's in San Francisco and this lobby that she's encountered so far. She's so visually taken by this person that she then totally disrupts his life and many, many other things in order to get some of that.
Yeah, it's offensive in a way that I can't I can't get past. And as we've heard on this podcast, previous episodes, I can get past a lot of really offensive stuff in order to enjoy a movie. And it was really hard for me to watch him say, like, just over and over and over again, like, no, please leave me alone. Please leave me alone. And not only does she ignore his expressed wishes, but she also ignores his reality, exerts her own narrative about reality onto his, and also his fiancé's reality.
Bernsey was telling about...
He's calling her Bernsey.
What was it, Bannister? Some incredible adventure you had on your flight here.
Yes. No!
I'm afraid my Howard is too modest to tell you that story himself, but it all began shortly after we passed the point of no return.
I think we just passed.
To create, like, a really warped experience for both of them throughout the first two-thirds of the movie, and it felt like watching two people be tortured, and it was really unpleasant.
When you talk about changing reality, I was going to say that this film obviously runs up against contemporary perspectives in terms of consent, is that he says no thank you and she says tough luck. But you're also basically saying that, if I'm hearing you correctly, that by constantly rampaging over the narrative of what is real, she's also engaged in a kind of gaslighting. That she's basically manipulating them into a situation where the relationship is broken apart, so he has no choice but to fall to her. But then also that the other character of his fiance, Eunice, is so traumatized that she's able to find somebody else because Judy has so fundamentally transformed Howard into who he was, into somebody else, that she therefore wouldn't work with him.
Yes, absolutely. And it happens over and over again. And it also happens where other characters are warped into, you know, like what is real, what is not real. And yeah, I don't know. It didn't sit right.
Now,
yeah.
Peter Bogdanovich, the director of this film, has said that it is an homage to the slapstick comedies of the 30s and 40s that he grew up with. That's very prominent in the marketing. The poster says something along the lines of, remember the screwball comedies we grew up with. And he wanted it to be an homage to Howard Hawks, who was a director he idolized and who he literally called while he was working on the script and made sure that he had approval from, because he felt that the script was very much inspired by his film Bringing Up Baby with Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn. And he wanted Ryan O'Neill's character to be Cary Grant, so much so that there are deliberate physical homages in the way in which his performance is. In Bringing Up Baby, Cary Grant's character is basically stunned into wordlessness by Katharine Hepburn. And that whole holding up your finger, trying to get a word in edgewise thing that O'Neill does in this is a mimicry of that performance. There's even an Easter egg in the film, which is that Cary Grant is notorious for having said a line that Cary Grant's character has never said in any movie, which is, "Judy, Judy, Judy." And the screenplay has Ryan O'Neill's character say that in the airport when Judy disappears. He goes,
"Well, Judy, I get... Judy? Judy."
And it's deliberately a call out to the most famous line that Cary Grant never said. So Bogdanovich is very deliberately creating what he thinks is an updated version of Bringing Up Baby. And one of the things that Pauline Kael excoriates him for in her review is saying, all you're doing is recreating the Howard Hawks films, but you're not bringing anything new to it. You're just reflecting films from 30 years ago. Cinema's too young for us to be retreading already and looking backwards. We need to be innovating, and you're not bringing any innovation to the table. You're just saying, I love old movies. That's why your movie is terrible. It's hollow. It's nothing except saying, I like old movies.
Well, I feel like he takes the worst part and none of the heart. Because I was curious, like, after watching this movie, I was like, well, I remember loving Bringing Up Baby, so let's go watch it.
And did you?
Yeah, so I sat down and I watched it. And what happens in the first, I don't know, 15 minutes of that movie, like the tearing of the jacket scene that gets recreated in What's Up, Doc.
Almost note for note.
Almost note for note.
Wait up, Steve! Oh, am I sorry. I'm terribly sorry.
Except that in Bringing Up Baby, she tears his jacket and then they turn around and he steps on her skirt and tears the back of her skirt. Something mutual happens, which is completely different than what happens in What's Up, Doc. And then he has to help her. And they have to do something together where it's like this team building activity where Cary Grant's like wrapped around her and they're like sort of like doing this dance walk through like through the lobby of wherever they are together. And they have a bonding moment. And then the next scene, we see him sort of confiding in her about his woes while she mends his jacket right there at that moment with him. And that heart is absent completely from What's Up, Doc, where the first, I would say, half of the movie of What's Up, Doc is just her, Judy's character, tormenting Howard. And we don't even get a sense that Howard cares for her at all or has any reason to. It's really just her throwing herself at him sort of senselessly and in this unreciprocated way where we don't see the core of really any joy until the last third of the movie where there's like sort of the chase scene. So I would say I see the echo of Bringing Up Baby, but I didn't see the warmth and the relationship and the charisma that is so naturally present in Bringing Up Baby.
Kael agrees with you. Kael says that Bringing Up Baby is a romance and that What's Up, Doc isn't. And that the relationship is completely empty.
Yeah,
now,
I agree.
Now, what I think that Bogdanovich sets up in What's Up, Doc is unfortunately a thin scum of anti-feminist character development.
Say in that, more.
In that, in Bringing Up Baby, you've got the woman that Cary Grant's character is engaged to is beautiful and smart and poised. What she isn't is, in the introduction, she says, "We're not going to have any children. We're not going to have any relationship. My job and my marriage will be to help you do your work." And she basically says, "I only care about this one piece of you, and the rest of it is irrelevant." So in Bringing Up Baby, we're very clearly given the sense of she doesn't appreciate his whole being, which we then see over the course of the picture, hopefully, that he is more than just his work. And so you, I believe, are supposed to say Katharine Hepburn's character likes all of him and therefore they will be better together because they will be all together as opposed to this very limited pedestal relationship that Miss Swallow has.
Yes.
The romantic foil that we're given in What's Up, Doc is the character played by Madeline Kahn of Eunice. And Eunice is given multiple opportunities to be laughed at in fairly horrible ways. There's a bit where she's in bed reading How to Be a Sensuous Woman, Volume 3, and she can't even deal with it. She's disgusted by what's on the page. She's trying to turn herself into a 70s woman, and she can't stomach it. There's the bit where Howard says that he's never seen her before, and she's dragged out of the ballroom with her heels squeaking on the tile floor with an added-in sound effect to make it even more cartoony. Her dismay and the savageness that Howard just basically lied in order to get this grant, betrayed his fiance, is just played for laughs. And Bogdanovich talks in the commentary track for the DVD, and it's one of the few times he laughs out loud at his own movie, is in the courtroom scene in the last quarter of the picture, when she says that she'd been assaulted sexually by the criminals that kidnapped her, the judge says,
"That's breaking and entering.
And they brought her with them forcibly.
That's kidnapping.
They tried to molest me.
That's unbelievable."
She is just there to be ugly and abandoned. And the more I've watched this movie, I'm impressed with Madeline Kahn's performance, but I am more and more unhappy with the way in which her character is created just so anybody looks better than her. Mm. And that final moment of the judge and the audience and the director being pleased at the idea that a woman is so awful as to be impossible to be believed that she could be assaulted really has not aged.
Yeah, I think that was another reason why this movie was so challenging, especially, like I mentioned, like the first two-thirds, really misogynistic, really, really pivots on this primary joke of this character being sort of the butt of all of the jokes. I think the last third, we sort of get into like some great slapstick, more classic kinds of farcical humor. But I don't think I was able to get around that. And I think especially what you're describing with that scene of the betrayal was really the punch in the gut, where it went from being just, regular misogyny, like regular movie misogyny.
Time-appropriate cultural misogyny?
I don't know. Yeah, it seems like they were like hitting especially hard, especially when I went back to watch Bringing Up Baby. It was almost like a stark contrast where it was so absent from the dynamics there and so present in What's Up, Doc. It was a stark contrast, and that was kind of telling, I think. There was almost like a backlash sort of element.
Smarter people than I have written long articles about the screwball comedy era and how feminist they are, because so many of those movies are basically placing men and women as competitive equals. And the romances of the time are basically saying how strong and powerful and verbal and witty and fantastic the women are. And that really it is in the 70s when auteur theory develops and men start becoming in charge of the movies that people have said a huge feminist voice disappeared from cinema that had been there in the 30s and the 40s. Mm. And I am basically badly mimicking things that I've read when I say that, but I would say that that is, unfortunately, one of the things that we're right in the midst of when this movie comes out is the huge confirmation of masculine narrative, masculine characters, masculine people behind the lens, redefining cinema as things that make men laugh for men. Mm. And that while Bogdanovich says that he is homaging the creators of the 40s, he's reestablishing Orson Welles and Howard Hawks, and he's really saying the men behind the camera are the most important thing that we should be celebrating, and he's not bringing the same Katharine Hepburn's and Irene Dunn's and incredibly powerful women of that era equally to the fore.
Right, because Bringing Up Baby was a script written for Katharine Hepburn, like the person of Katharine Hepburn. Is that right?
Well, I think no. I think Philadelphia Story is the movie that was the bringing Katharine Hepburn back that she and Philip Barry, the playwright, were working hard to make sure that, because somewhere between Bringing Up Baby in 1936 and Philadelphia Story in 1940, Hepburn's star had already crested and fallen, and she was labeled as box office poison and couldn't get a movie made. Mm. So I think there were enough things that had tried to put her in movie jail and remove her from the narrative. I think Bringing Up Baby is still her on the upswing, and then very quickly after that, she gets her knees taken out from under her.
Well, according to Wikipedia, it was written for her and tailored to her personality.
That doesn't surprise me, but...
we can double check that and put it in the show notes.
Yeah, but I think it was probably written for her in part. But it was also, that film also was not universally beloved at the time, because it was part of the poison pen aspect of Katharine Hepburn that started her down the road of people saying, no thanks, for a little bit before she was able to reestablish her cultural dominance at the time.
And it's not a perfect movie either. Like, there were parts of it that really didn't sit right when I was rewatching it, but it's nothing like watching somebody, like, I don't know. It's like a very...
So what is different about Hepburn's manipulation of Grant's character? Because she falls in love with him. She decides. She has the realization in the bar when she's speaking to the psychologist. She's like, oh, he's fixated on me. And that's where a switch goes in her head. And she's like, oh, if he's in love with me, which he isn't, but she listens to the psychologist and thinks that he must be, and therefore decides, excellent, he's the perfect man for me. And then she's in love with him thereafter. Hmm. That's the moment that her character motivation snaps into place. And then after that, she's just doing everything because she's in love with him and she doesn't want him to get married the next day. I mean, how is Katharine Hepburn's character deciding she's going to destroy his next day marriage better?
It's not. It isn't better. It isn't better, I think. But the thing, and I did not have a chance to watch all of Bringing Up Baby, so I don't want to speak to all of it. But what I did watch, what I saw over and over again, is like Cary Grant is acting as of his own volition. He's acting, he's moving towards her, and he's having moments of affection. He's expressing admiration for her, and he's expressing his agency. He's choosing to go on these adventures, like even if he's being manipulated in parts along the way. I saw a much different dynamic in terms of the, I guess, like the level of manipulation or like boundary violation.
So you think that therefore Ryan O'Neill's character of Howard Bannister has no agency?
Not that he has no agency. And I would say that that scene where he betrays his fiance is a moment where he has agency and he expresses it, and it's reprehensible and it's terrible and I hate him.
Tell them who I am. I insist you tell them who I am right this minute.
I never saw her before in my life.
I think that's like one of the sort of distinguishing arcs of a movie is like what's happening with these characters. Like, not only do the characters in What's Up, Doc not really seem to like each other, you know, like the two main romantic leads, but also like I hate them. Judy, who's supposed to be Bugs Bunny, she's no Bugs Bunny. Like, she's not under any threat. You know, she is the threat. So I'm not sympathetic to her. And as a romantic lead, she's uncompelling. She is the hunter, right? Hmm. She's going after this guy who expresses
I think
he's not interested.
There are
she ignores
people
it.
Who are Bugs Bunny connoisseurs who will tell you that while sometimes Bugs starts off as being hunted or is about to be cooked, there are plenty of times when he just starts off as the aggressor. Just from word go, he's like, you know what? Actually, I've decided to make everyone else's life a misery because I'm a trickster god, and that's all that matters.
It's true. It's true. I agree. But I think that the central conceit and why we're willing to go along with it is that he's sympathetic because...
he's a rabbit.
Ultimately, he is being hunted and is the victim. And
so even if that doesn't carry over from cartoon to cartoon, it's still in the essential weft of the character.
Yes. It's been a while since I've watched Bugs Bunny.
Fair.
But I think that, like, just thinking of, like, how do we feel culturally about Bugs Bunny? It's like that, mm-hmm. He's allowed because the initiating event is that he was being hunted. And then the second thing that was being happened is that he's like drawing a train on a wall for somebody to get run over. It was defensive. You know, like you were saying, it's not always defensive. But in this case, the initiating event was, you know, like that she wanted some guy because he was a babe. and it feels really bad, you know, to watch her manipulate this guy who's got a fiance, especially like the misogyny implied and like how the movie just takes down Eunice like line after line. It's awful. I don't know. I can't.
So the script has a bit of a strange history in that Barbara Streisand was married to Elliot Gould and they were separated when he was attempting to make a movie based on a novel called A Glimpse of Tiger by Hermann Rauscher. And Glimpse of Tiger is about a young woman who's dropped out of college, who is living life as a grifter and sort of faking her way through different scenarios. And in the first 3 days of filming, Elliot Gould infamously went on what everybody else describes as a freak out and what he describes as everyone else is overreacting to this. So much so that he basically was not allowed to make movies for about 3 years after that because everybody was scared to death of his instability.
Whoa, that's juicy. I never heard that.
It was a huge thing. And because he was involved with the producing and starring of the film, he was therefore on the hook financially for its dissolution. And in the book Streisand, Her Life by James Spada, the author claims that Streisand went to the execs at Warner Brothers, specifically a man named John Calley, and said, I'm worried that my now ex-husband is going to be destroyed by his financial obligation to this. Is there anything I can do to help? And they basically said, well, you could take over some of the responsibility for A Glimpse of Tiger, and therefore it won't be a total loss. What if we rewrite the main character so that it's not a charismatic man grifter, but it's a woman, and you should be the lead of A Glimpse of Tiger? And she was like, great, I've just made this comedy. I now want to do a movie that is a serious drama about social issues. And I think this film about people who are disenfranchised and trying to live out of the system will be a great way to do that. I've just seen a preview screening of The Last Picture Show by Peter Bogdanovich. It's very emotional. It's all about generational change and depression. I think this is the guy to do it. And then he swans in and says, I don't want to make a drama. Let's turn it into a comedy. And that is how A Glimpse of Tiger becomes What's Up, Doc, through three different screenwriters and Bogdanovich's influence. It goes from being based on a novel about social disenfranchisement to being about a casual grifter who's just walking around manipulating people until she falls in love with a square professor, and then because she's a free spirit, she decides to turn him into her.
How bizarre.
And the most of that last bit comes from screenwriter Buck Henry, who is a massively well-respected comic writer who had worked with Streisand on The Owl and the Pussycat screenplay, is well known for having created Get Smart, I mean, he also adapted the novel for The Graduate, so he's not just a comedian in terms of his writing, but is mostly thought of as well-respected for being an incredible comic voice. And he's the person that punched up the screenplay that had been worked on by Bogdanovich and these two other writers and turned it into this massive slapstick. So Henry never read the novel. The other two screenwriters that worked with Bogdanovich said they also never read the novel. They just took the basic premise of grifter who's dropped out of college but has taken a lot of classes and knows lots of fun, strange, obscure things, and had no grounding in a socio-political reality of that. And then just said, that's funny, let's run with that. That's what Streisand's character is based on. A thing that's divorced from any context whatsoever.
Now that checks out, because it feels a little disjointed from any other part. Like, the parts don't really fit together, which I think it could be one of the criticisms of this movie.
One of the things that allows her to be, though, is everything. And I think that's what people who are charmed by this movie, always acknowledging that's not you.
That's okay. I like some parts of this movie. We'll get to that.
But that her hyperverbal ability to always have a retort, always have a reference, always have the ability to yes and a situation, so that when she lies, she can pepper it with details for things. Whenever somebody brings something up, she knows something relevant about it.
That money would enable me to travel to the south of France to examine evidence of prehistoric art forms hundreds of thousands of years old.
Ordination or Upper Perigordia?
Well, both, actually. Now, if I'm given the... Where do you come up with those names?
Just a wild guess.
Is all born out of the absolutely impossible comic scenario, as she's been bounced out of so many colleges that she knows just a little bit about everything. And as somebody who is a professional jack of all trades, that is hugely attractive as an or text figure of, she's basically a comedian intellectual Batman.
I love it. I did find it to be an uncommon set of characteristics, especially for a female character. I don't often see a setup where it's like, oh, I know, let's make a female character who's super smart and super hot. Do you think that she was kind of a Mary Sue, though?
For whom? I mean, who is she the wish fulfillment for?
But not like a wish fulfillment thing, but just that she's like...
Well, you know, that unfortunately, to me, is what the term Mary Sue means, is that it's the avatar of the writer or the wish fulfillment character of the audience saying, I want to be that person.
Or just that, like, the writer has, like, maxed out on every... Do you know what I mean? You know, like...
Yes, that slightly... inaccurate definition of Mary Sue, I get. Yes, that it's like, she's Harry Potter. She's got everything. She's the best at everything.
Yeah.
She walks into a situation and everybody's like, oh, you're amazing. And you can do whatever you want. And here's $10,000 in Gringotts and the best broomstick before it's been released onto the market and all that other kinds of wish.
And your dad is the judge.
Yeah. Right, because it's her get out of jail free card.
Yeah, I thought it was, the conception of the character was fun.
I think that this character is potentially more disastrously related to another problem, which is one of the comic engines of the movie is that she's a jinx. Is that no matter what, things go wrong around her. She walks across a street, and because she's doing her thing, other people get into a car accident.
Mm-hmm.
When she shows up, things break, things fall down, everything goes wrong. That she just walks into a room and bad things happen. That is totally unrealistic, but fun in terms of she's a chaos engine, the engine that's always making, therefore, things fall down or break around her, which is very entertaining for the audience. Let me finish my point.
Okay.
That leads to the career of Katherine Heigl, where you have, therefore, a person who's pretty and winsome and wonderful, but who is a klutz. It's a bad reading on the What's Up Doc trope, where she walks in and everything goes wrong around her, Instead, you've got to have the person that's tripping and falling and doing things and is pretty and wonderful, but who can't get things right. And instead of saying that everything she causes things to go wrong, it's a way of leavening the perfection of the model that we've hired to be the romantic lead, and things go wrong to her, therefore supposedly making her sympathetic.
The difference there that I would say is that with Katherine Hegel, she is sympathetic. She has empathy, for one, which which Barbra Streisand's Judy character, that's part of the reason why it really hits different, is because all of this stuff is happening to people around her, and she has this shruggy indifference that comes across as sociopathic. And in a cartoon character, I mean, especially since you start watching it as a kid, you're like, this is normal, right? But, you know, I think as an adult, maybe we'd have like a different experience of that. But though the cartoon character, you sort of like suspend your need for the characters to have a conscience or empathy. But in a live action movie, I think it feels really terrible to watch somebody like not care that a car accident happens or that a motorcyclist, you know, falls down right near you. And so I think that's part of the reason why Judy's character comes across as problematic to me.
See, that's interesting. I think one of the things that Bogdanovich has successfully done in this movie is make it a live-action cartoon. That while the people are people and not drawings, they are largely sets of characteristics that are just wound up and spun. Most of his actors are wonderful character actors, and therefore they're able to be a thing as opposed to being realistic with hearts and souls. They're played broadly, they're played comedically, and they're very much engines for a type. And that's one of the things that the New York Times criticizes him for. He says, these aren't real people. But I think that's Bogdanovich's intent. And I think if you're trying to look for emotional reality in this, you're missing the fact that it's named What's Up, Doc after a Bugs Bunny cartoon, and it ends with Porky Pig saying, that's all, folks. It is a cartoon. It's just peopled with actors.
Sure, but okay, but you want to like have your cake and eat it too, not you specifically, but Bogdanovich.
No, we can say me.
I think that there's elements of that are done really well. Like when Judy's standing at the window of the pizza shop, the guy's like tossing the pizza, and he tosses up in the air, and then it never comes back down. And like, that's adorable, and this is like a very successful place where it sort of like crosses over between cartoon and reality. This is cartoon-like. And it's really fun.
But also in terms of the production design and the costume design, think of Eunice's colors. Think about her astonishingly red wig and her astonishingly green dresses. Think about how garish the hotel is. It's basically what Richard Gere does later with Dick Tracy, where everything is hyper bright popping colors in order to say, it's a comic strip, people.
Hi, Future Ben here. Past Ben, of course, was referring to Warren Beatty, who directed and starred in Dick Tracy. Why he was confusing him with Richard Gere is anyone's guess, except for the fact that they were both sexy leading men of a particular era. So for all of those people who were screaming at their speakers saying, come on, you should know better than that, please know that Future Ben also spent the next hour of this recording waiting for Past Ben to realize his mistake and correct it so that he could edit it in and hide this hideous gaffe. However, Past Ben never figured it out, the big bozo.
Except it's not based on a comic strip, so it doesn't have the art direction background. They're basically just saying, remember it's a cartoon. Remember it's a Warner Brothers cartoon. And they're doing that with the costume design and the haircuts and the performances.
Yeah, and I think that some of that is done really successfully. But when you cross over and you want to...
So what's the... Tell me about the crossover point, because this is where I think we're diverting.
Well, when it's like scene after scene where somebody is being repeatedly harassed, manipulated, and gaslit, and it's supposed to be funny, but what we're seeing is like someone's real emotional experience of pain and suffering, that's not funny because it's a person. They're not a cartoon. It's hard to just laugh at that.
Do you think that Eunice is reacting like a real person would react?
Yes, yeah, like some real people would react. I think some real people would dip out a lot earlier, but I don't know. I guess I hadn't really thought of that question like while I was watching the movie, but
you just took the reality of this woman is being mistreated because I know she's a woman because I'm looking at her on film. And therefore, you were projecting an emotional reality of how much it would suck if somebody did that to you.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that she, as an actress, is creating and performing a character who is not reacting in an emotionally consistent way.
Hart, I am going to count to five.
Don't count, Eunice. I hate it when you count.
One.
That a human being would do in those circumstances. She is acting like a cartoon character.
Oh, you don't think that she's acting like a person would react?
No.
Hello, Eunice. Come on in.
Well, yeah. I mean, maybe not super consistently, but I guess, like, same thing with Howard Bannister's character. Like, I don't think any movie is necessarily a consistent portrayal of how a human would react, but that doesn't keep me from responding emotionally to their portrayal of pain and suffering. And so watching somebody be sort of tormented over and over again, like, it doesn't feel good, you know? And so...
Yes, I agree with that.
And so where the line between, like, this human cartoonism and human suffering is, it's not super clear, and I guess I didn't like it. It's not like watching Bugs Bunny for me. It's not like watching a human Bugs Bunny. It's like watching real human suffering, and that's where it didn't work.
I wonder if it had been, instead of in 70s color, but in black and white, whether you would have thought of it more like Bringing Up Baby or more like the Marx Brothers. Whether there would have been something that he could have done as a filmmaker to create a filter or a veil of making it feel distant enough that you could have then responded to the characters not as human. To still have actors do it instead of it being a cartoon and then have clicked in with his, what I think is his very deliberate attempt to have everybody be acting in non-realistic manner. So let me bring up a specific example.
Yeah.
The hotel detective and the German desk clerk.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a tall, Aryan, blonde, German-accented man behind the desk and a round, chubby, balding man as his criminal sidekick who's dumb enough to be given the instruction, charm her.
Oh my God, that was hilarious. That
he trips the woman and just basically manhandles her for 17 floors in order to try and prevent her from getting into a room.
Charm her, charm her. That was one of my favorite scenes.
In the scene right before that happens, they're talking about the fact that he hasn't successfully stolen her jewels. And the desk clerk, whose name is Hans or Fritz, because there's the whole bit about which one it is, and I can't remember which one it actually is.
I can't remember either.
Says,
what kind of a house detective are you? Cannot commit a simple burglary.
I'm ashamed.
It's basically a comic strip. It's basically a one-panel Far Side cartoon. Mm-hmm. The two of them short and tall next to each other. He doesn't say the line with any realistic human delivery. It's arbor-shamed. Like, it's so cartoony. And then it turns into the extended montage of the trip thing, where he trips her in the lobby and then continues to do it up in the hallway. And the thing in the hotel lobby was filmed in San Francisco during the first week of filming, and the thing in the hallway was filmed 3 weeks later in Los Angeles on a soundstage. And in the commentary, Bogdanovich talks about the fact that they were just going to do the one trip in the lobby, but that they laughed so hard at it in the dailies that they decided to turn it into a long extended bit. And therefore, weeks later, they were like, yeah, let's go back to the tripping thing. Let's make that a huge long runner where they're doing it down the hallway and she's biting his leg and fighting it off. And it just turns into a big cartoon, a completely unrealistic thing. She would have yelled for help. Somebody would have stopped. Instead, she's wearing her super bright dress in that totally garish hallway after he's just delivered a Far Side cartoon punchline. Nothing about it is real.
Yeah, that's all fine.
That
stuff was funny. And like the whole end of the movie, like the whole last third with like
the car chase,
all that stuff, the courtroom scene, all of this is like hilarious to me.
It's just the emotional reality of a woman seeing a man across a lobby and being like, I'm going to destroy his life, that you can't wrap your emotional brain around.
Yeah, it's like the close-up scripting that they did of her over and over again being like, oh yeah, no, he's my fiance, you know, to the store clerk, or telling everybody at the whatever it's called.
At the conference?
The conference, yes. That
the College of Musicologists?
That she's the fiance, you know, lying, manipulating him to betray his actual fiance. Yeah.
That's interesting on a couple of different levels. On the one hand, yes, there's the emotional component. But on the other hand, there's the mild satire of the fact that she's lying and getting away with it. So there's the specific scene where Ryan O'Neal's character has been trying to get her attention to say, look, this lie is not going to be sustainable. We need to talk about it and create an exit strategy. I'm freaking out over here. And she says, meet me under the table. And he's like, what? And she says, oh no, I dropped my napkin. And then they duck under the table in order to compare notes. At which point then, because it's a total unsubtle thing that they're doing, and they're under there for more than a half a second, everybody else joins them. And instead of doing the normal thing and saying, sorry, we were just trying to say something in secret to each other.
Is that the normal
says,
thing?
What's going on?
Anything wrong?
No.
Just testing a theory how it has about vocal reverberation under spinal pressure.
What? Vocal reverberation under spinal pressure?
You know, VRUSP.
Oh, of course.
Yes, I think I read a monograph on that.
Because nobody's willing to admit that anything could be wrong. They're always, the story she tells about the fact that he was able to use the magnetic resonance on rocks to fix an airplane is so bad of a lie. And it's only Kenneth Mars' character of Hugh Simon that's like, I find that story hard to swallow. Everyone else is just wowed by it because no one's realistically responding to totally ludicrous claims. Her whole grifter thing doesn't stand up to scrutiny, with the possible exception of the trick with the room service, where even then they should have a list of who's in what room and therefore don't charge an account to that room because nobody's in it. Everything else, she's wholly unbelievable, except for the fact that these are academics and people who are attracted to her, and therefore they're willing to give her the benefit of the doubt. It's basically every story about grifter white ladies that's going on Hulu and Netflix and Showtime at the moment, where they're all like basically predicated on the idea that if a cute white woman walks in and says, I'm trustworthy, you should give me lots of money, people are going, okay, sounds good to me. And then years later, they're like, crap, we shouldn't have done that. And then they sell their life story and make a special on it.
So you agree that this is annoying?
That wasn't actually where I was going.
That the center of this scene is like her having like, what is his name? Like Lonergan or whatever, having like his hand like pressed on her chest being like, oh, my heart is beating so fast. Can you feel it?
Can't you feel it?
Yes, I think I can. It's absolutely. It's certainly in there pounding. It's amazing. You should feel it, gentlemen. Sit down, gentlemen, please.
I mean, the cartoonishness of that scene, like, I get it. You know, like, all the guys, like, stand up from the table, like, oh, they want to feel her heartbeat. And it does have, like, that Marx Brothers kind of, like, goofy slapstick kind of punchline to it.
I mean, you want to talk about sociopaths. Groucho Marx.
I know. I know. But I feel like what I remember from those movies just wasn't this, like, intensified, prolonged person on person, like, I'm going to follow you around, attached to you, and like run this.
I think you should watch the way in which Groucho Marx deliberately manipulates Margaret Sullivan in those movies, where he basically attaches to her like a lamprey and says, you're rich and powerful, and I'm going to screw up whoever is courting you and get in the way so that I can get to the end and basically live off your money.
You know what? Maybe, okay, I think that there's two main differences. One, those movies were funny. Two, the person was in on the joke. You know, eventually, like, she throws the back of her hand on her forehead and she laughs along, you know, with him. She like rolls her eyes and she's like, oh Groucho, you know. and that too is the element of bringing up Baby that felt like it was tolerable, is those moments where like Cary Grant is in on it. He wants to be there with Katharine Hepburn, and you kind of like sigh, you like your body relaxes a little bit, you're like, okay, this is okay. Like, he's saying no, but you know, he's choosing yes. You can see him saying yes at the same time. It's not like this coercive thing, he's choosing it. And that's, I think, what was missing from What's Up Doc, where it was this like real structural thing that she's creating.
I think it's not at all difficult to read this as an incredibly bad example of what the current narrative is about a lot of rom-coms, that they are in fact predicated on being really bad about consent and about tricking people into basically saying, if I keep on pushing you long enough, you'll say yes. Like, that is a thing that legitimately has been pointed out about a lot of movies in the 80s, particularly, as a thing that's like, we shouldn't be basing our romantic ideals on that behavior. And this is a forerunner to that. 100%. I don't disagree with any of that. I'm merely saying nobody in this film is actually human. And to therefore project any realistic behaviors of that's a thing I should do is like saying, oh, Bugs Bunny hits people in the face with a mallet, therefore it's okay for me to do that.
I would say, yes, I agree with you, except some of these intense psychological behaviors that they're portraying in the movie are above and beyond the mere cartoonishness either.
I saw this movie on video when I was young because it was rated G.
I know, it's insane. That's not right.
And we had very strict ratings policies in terms of what we were and were not allowed to see in my household. And out of absolute desperation, I was like, I don't think this is a movie I would like based on its stars, but it's got a Bugs Bunny title and it's G-rated and we're running out of good options. And the scene with the ladder and the pane of glass and the cars stuck with me so much that I watched Pink Panther movies for years afterwards, being like, where's that scene with the broken glass? Where's that scene with the ladder and the cars? Because I was convinced that kind of slapstick only existed in Blake Edwards movies. And was mystified as to where it was until I one day rediscovered it in this movie and was like, oh my gosh, there it is. Absent the relationship stuff, you said that the second two-thirds of this movie, the car chase and the courtroom scene, you found slapsticky and comic and successful. Is that true?
Yeah, I think it's really the last third. I think that the first...
Yeah, I'd say timing-wise, the first half is up to the burning of the hotel room. And then you've got a third to a quarter of then getting all the bags. And then the last... whatever, quarter or a third, is the car chase into the courtroom.
Yeah, what I had in my timing was that it's like at about the hour mark is like when the fight scene happens.
Okay.
And that's when I really started enjoying myself, is like that fight scene is amazing.
I can't disagree more.
Ooh, tell me why.
Well, Pauline Kael's review talks about the fact that she feels like some of the camera angles and staging and timing of the slapstick is bad. And to me, that's the example where it doesn't work. That you can see when they yelled action and when they started filming and when they cut, and it's not quite in sync. There's an anecdote that comes up in the commentary, which is that in the screenplay, Buck Henry wrote, And there's a big fight scene here that will be expertly choreographed by the director. But he didn't write any of the things that happened except for the one bit where the maid grabs the gun and shoots a bunch of shots wildly. Everything else they figured out on the day. They had the set and they're like, okay, based on where we are, let's figure out what the fight choreography is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's opportunistic, which isn't a problem, but it does mean that it doesn't make any sense and it's not quite timed right. I think that many, many, many sequences in this movie have exceptional timing.
Hmm.
And this is the one bit that doesn't work, where you can see them not quite getting the timing right and whiffing. So for me, this is the bit where I'm like, okay, I'll wait for this to be over and then I'll go back to liking this movie.
Really? Okay. Well, it's okay to be wrong.
I agree with you completely. But for the opposite reasons.
Well, I thought that the set was really fun. I liked when they had the gun on the clear spiral stairs. I feel like that scene is watching just for that piece of modern art. I think that like it never gets old to me when somebody like goes to throw a punch and then they like miss the person that they're trying to punch and they punch the person behind them. And there was a couple of examples of that.
Mm-hmm.
I also liked when the two main protagonists left out the front door and the butler sort of like closed the door behind them and turned around and sort of like stood there. Both times I watched that, it just really hit this thing about that butler that I'll never forget.
I think the butler is great. And I think he's the best button on that scene.
Yeah.
I think his, I'm being steadfast and I'm not participating because it is beneath me. I think he's hilarious. I think he's even hilarious when he lets him in. He's the right tone. But the timing of all the comic violence and the stuff in the bed. Legendarily, when you watch Braveheart, when you're not paying attention to the people in the foreground, apparently in the background you can see the extras like missing completely, talking, hanging out. Like they're just apparently really bad. And if you therefore watch something often enough where you're no longer distracted by like the plot and the characters, you can start to notice the things. And I think I've seen this movie often enough that I'm now at the part where all I can see are the flaws in that sequence.
I see. Well, I think it's really fun. And I think it's even more fun that there's all these flaws in that scene to notice. I think that's really cool. And I think that that house is so cool and such like an artifact of that era that it's almost like worth watching for that.
It would be remiss of me to not give credit in terms of the design of that house, because the interior was done purely in blacks and whites. Everything in the background is white walls and black art hanging on it and the clear stairs in order to have a background that the action can happen against and therefore be very noticeable. And that was done by the production designer, Polly Platt. And Polly Platt is the subject of a lengthy podcast by Katrina Longworth called You Must Remember This. She did a like 8-part series based on Polly Platt, her journey, and her relationship with director Peter Bogdanovich, to whom she was married at the time, despite the fact that he was having multiple affairs with other people, and she was still working for him in order to be able to get into the guild of production designers at the time, using this movie as a gateway. She is the person who, in her memoirs, says that she said that Barbara Streisand's character should be the manic one and that the male should be a stuffy professor. That originally they were going to have her be the naif and be the person that was sort of, the phrase she uses is a nagging yenta. And that idea that she was the conniving con artist came from Polly Platt. Bogdanovich gives her no credit for that. In his multiple interviews and commentaries, he says that it was his idea. They're both dead now. I don't know who to trust, but it's interesting to listen to several hours of podcast about Polly Platt and the way in which he refers to Platt multiple times in the commentary dismissively is ugly.
It's disappointing. I thought she did a great job with that set.
Yeah, and they're fascinating just little moments in terms of them battling for credit. She says that she worked very well with Streisand, that they were very close, that she was the person who was able to talk her into agreeing with things, particularly costumes. And then in the commentary, Bogdanovich says, I chose her that shirt. She did this because of me. They're warring over who was the most important influence in making this movie in their various narratives and things.
Well, I guess
I don't know the truth, but I do want to point out one specific bit where it's very clear that Bogdanovich's recall is not always perfect. And I bring this up because it connects to an earlier moment in our podcast, which is that the actor Michael Murphy plays the whistleblower who has the top secret papers in one of the four bags. And Michael Murphy, we've seen previously in both MASH and Brewster McCloud. He's the doctor in Japan. He's the anesthetist in Japan. And he's the hotshot cop in the black turtleneck who dies in a car accident in the end of Brewster McCloud. And his character is named Shaft in a weird confluence of, like, the movie Shaft came out the same year as that. And we talked about that. And it's clear that his costume choices are based on the 1968 Steve McQueen vehicle Bullet, that he's obviously being some sort of weird macho cop in Brewster McCloud. Bogdanovich says, oh, that's Michael Murphy. He was great in Bullet. That's why we cast him in this role.
That's so weird.
Bogdanovich saw him satirize Bullet in Brewster McCloud and remembered incorrectly that he saw him actually in Bullet.
That's so funny. Oh my God.
So I really enjoyed being like, no, Bogdanovich, you got that wrong, film historian.
Okay, well, that's...
You watched the Weird Al version and you got the wrong end of the stick.
Well, a lot of people think that Sarah Palin and... I can't think of her name. Yeah, Tina Fey is the same person.
Anything else about the characters, the romance, the politics, the believability that you want to go over?
Oh, I don't know.
Is there anything that you feel strongly about the movie that you feel like you haven't said?
I think we probably covered a lot of it, except that the chase scene stuff at the end is like really good, but we'll probably cover that in like the favorite scene stuff. It's usually when I get going into my like, I loved this.
Yeah, and somehow I don't think by the time we get round to our fifth of five favorite moments, you're going to have turned around and say, I think I'm going to watch it again. I think you're going to be like, nope.
No.
I've had my fill of this for at least a decade, if not forever. But maybe I'll finish watching Bringing Up Baby.
Yeah. No, I'm good. I just can't believe some of the, like, lines in this, like...
If you're not out of here, in 2 minutes, I'm calling the police.
Who do you think they'll arrest? The girl in the tub or the guy with his pants down?
Like, it's just so horrifying. And, like, if the situation were reversed, if it was...
If it had been the original where she was the nagging Yenta and he was the con artist.
Yeah, like, these are the words of an abuser, you know? Mm. And it's hard to decontextualize that and put it in the psychological context of a cartoon when it's really heavy stuff.
And yet, when I watch this, I can't give it any weight. I can't treat it as a realistic set of circumstances. And so my ability to project, aside from the abuse that Madeline Kahn's character gets, pretty much everything else. I mean, I get it. The moment where they're under the table and Howard Bannister, in order to get $20,000, betrays his fiance while looking into the eyes of a woman who has been lying up and down the street and is basically proven herself to be feckless. I mean, that is a absolute moment that shows the hole in his soul where character should be. And the fact that he recovers as a character after that shouldn't work. Mm. We shouldn't ever forgive him.
Mm-hmm.
But because the movie is saying Eunice isn't good enough for him, she's short and she wears a wig, and therefore he needs to be tall and handsome with somebody who's hot with a New York accent. They basically shift the stakes and say the emotional reality of that moment doesn't matter as long as the pretty people end up with the pretty people.
It's dark.
I'm about to go on a tangent that I'm going to cut out of this.
I'm here for it.
But there's a bit in Mallory's Arthurian myths where Arthur's round table is there and they've set themselves up in judgment. And a man, a farmer, who's described as bent and gnarled like an old apple tree, shows up and says, "My wife has been unfaithful to me. And I know, because look at our children." And he points, and there are 7 sons, and 6 of them all look like bent and gnarled like him. And one of them is this gigantic, handsome oak tree of a man. And the wife steps forward and says, "It's true. I did have an affair. A knight was riding by, and he was so taken with me that we slept together, and this child is the offspring." And King Arthur says, "Well, he is clearly the son of a knight, and therefore the infidelity is okay, because look what it has produced. It has produced somebody that I shall invite to be on my Knights of the Round Table. You, woman, are blessed to have been impregnated by a knight, and you, sir, should be glad that your woman was so attractive that she bore him this great son." Whenever I watch movies that are basically the message is pretty people should be with other pretty people, I think about the fact that this has been around since the 1200s.
Yeah. Or longer, I'm sure.
Yeah.
That's depressing.
Not anyway, really I've been sure thinking about that since I was 20. As always, the morally ambiguous people at random.org have provided us with a service that has allowed me to select 1 minute from the, I believe, 93-minute movie. And so the numbers spun, the dial twitched, and we came up with minute 23. Anna is going to watch those 60 seconds. She will then have 30 seconds to attempt to summarize its contents. If she is able to do that, she will start the quiz with a bonus point, which will therefore give her the edge at getting 3 out of 4 points.
Okay, I'm going to watch it.
All right.
Mr. Larrabee,
I'm your Simon. Mr. Larrabee, I would like to say I love your hair.
Thank you.
I would like to say on behalf of myself and of course all of my colleagues at the conservatory.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this.
Oh, you're laughing at the futility of the exercise. I was about to say, I thought you didn't like this movie.
No, it's really, I mean, I think like the more I watch it, the funnier it gets.
Ooh, yeah. Excellent. The movie itself is gaslighting you, much like the characters are gaslighting each other. It is funny. It is funny.
The bits are really funny. Like if I can just sort of like shove.
If you can ignore the emotional hole.
The central conflict, just like shove that to the side and then ignore it, then it gets easier to handle.
It's true. Be like me, emotionally dead inside, yeah, and then it's hilarious.
Just cold and numb and hardened. Yeah. Yes.
And then you'll laugh like a drain. Yeah. All right. You have 30 seconds to summarize the 60 seconds starting now.
Okay. Hugh Simon approaches Mr. Larrabee, introduces himself, tosses his hair back, takes first one hand of Mr. Larrabee, then the other, and starts monologuing at him about how he deserves the prize, twirling him around like they are dancing with both hands in Mr. Larrabee's hands at the same time. Then Mr. Larrabee sees Mr. Simon and tilts his head to the side to try to read
5 seconds left.
Mr. Bannister's upside down name tag. Is that the end?
Time!
I feel like there are parts that I missed.
I mean, mean, you didn't attempt to say what Hugh says, which I think was wise. But you very aptly described the action. And aside from the fact that you misidentified Mr. Bannister as Mr. Simon, I think you did everything perfectly. So I'm going to grant you a point.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I'm going to say you earned a point. I grant you nothing. It has nothing to do with me.
That's right. Earned it. Earned it.
Well, it was a interesting minute. And in the true spirit of fulfilling the obligations to the gods of random.org, I couldn't necessarily find much in this minute to write trivia on, except for one strange piece of language, which is that Hugh says, though he shuns financial things, that this grant will give him the gloire enorme that will allow him and his organization to proceed. And it is a phrase that Mr. Larrabee quotes back to him. And I didn't know that phrase. In fact, I knew that it was French, but I misheard it. I thought they said gloire énorme, meaning glory and something else. But instead, it basically means awesome glory or huge fame. Gloire énorme, enormous glory. And so I looked up different instances, occurrences, and the history of the phrase gloire énorme. Question number one. The phrase gloire énorme may have been coined by Victor Hugo. It does not appear in either Les Misérables or the Hunchback of Notre Dame, but it instead first appears in one of his lesser-known works. Which of the following can you find that phrase? A. The Man Who Laughs, a novel about a disfigured nobleman who uses the phrase ironically to refer to the vastness of the depravity of the human soul. B. The play Cromwell, about Oliver Cromwell, and the phrase is used to describe the human capacity for dignity in throwing off royalist oppression. Or C. The book of poetry, The Art of Being a Grandfather, wherein he describes the depth of love he has as a protector for his offspring and as an inspiration to instill love of country.
A.
No, unfortunately, it appears in The Art of Being a Grandfather.
What the hell? That's so weird. But who writes that?
Well, let me tell you, in question number two, The Art of Being a Grandfather was written by Hugo for which of the following three reasons? A. He wrote it during exile, while the Franco-Prussian War raged and Paris was under siege in 1871, because he was afraid that his grandchildren would be raised under German rule and without his patriotic influence. B. He wrote it because his grandchildren were being raised by only women, as their fathers had been conscripted into the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, and he feared that they were under undue female influence. Or C. In 1871, Hugo's son died of a stroke at 44, and Hugo had to raise his grandchildren as all of his other sons and daughters were also dead. So he wrote poems of life lessons for them.
C.
Correct. Yeah, that's what the whole poem is about. It's about you have to love your country and learn important things because I might die soon and you have no other family.
Nice.
Question number three. However, the phrase probably became known in the past and therefore was quoted in this screenplay because it was in a quotation in a newspaper about a powerful international figure in the 1880s. French critic Jules Lemaître used the phrase about whom? A. Sarah Bernhardt's performance of Jeanne d'Arc. B. Guy de Maupassant's publication of The Necklace. Or C. Friedrich Nietzsche's refutation of nihilism in Also Sprach Zarathustra.
C.
No, it's notably used about Sarah Bernhardt. And basically, the two places in which you can find gloire énorme if you search Google book scans in the French language are reviews or commentary about reviews of Sarah Bernhardt and in this Victor Hugo poem.
Now I know.
The complete quotation about Bernhardt by Lemaître is, in English, "She has the enormous, concrete, maddening glory of conquerors and the Caesars. The continued influence of this remark is why the French film rewards are called the Césars. True or false?
True.
Unfortunately, no.
Dang it.
Nope, the Césars are named after sculptor César Baldacchini, who designed the award. So unfortunately, you only got one correct.
It's okay, you can't win them all. Plus the bonus point,
which means you got 50%.
Wow.
Which is almost a victory.
Oh, yeah. That's right. I had a good streak, though, you know.
You did have a great streak.
Can't win them all, and did good, tried hard. You know, it's always next time. And shout out to my coach and, you know.
Just got to acknowledge that the other team tried real hard. And Ben did a good job of writing the questions. I know he played fair. And I just need, you know, got to get out there and get some real spirit and heart.
Exactly.
All right. Jesus saves. All right.
I know no one can see Ben, but he is wearing a tracksuit.
Didn't think about that while I was doing that. Yeah, I'm definitely wearing an Adidas warm-up jacket. It is, however, an Adidas warm-up jacket from the Tron Legacy 3D IMAX. So it's allows me to sweat and come down after the intense visual experience of seeing CG Jeff Bridges in 3D.
It's really working. That's all I'm saying.
Really gotta, whew, gotta process this. Uncanny Valley.
You're an Uncanny Valley. Oh, man.
As always, we end each episode talking about our five favorite moments. A moment is not a full scene, but it's a piece of performance, of writing, of production, or just a thing that made us stop and smile and appreciate the weirdness that is filmmaking. Anna, I liked this movie. I was glad to cover this movie. I can barely narrow my list down to five. Do you want to start or do you want me to start?
It sounds like you should go first.
Or it would be good for me to only have the two options. I don't know which.
No, I think it would be good if you went first.
All right. For my first favorite moment, the initial meeting between Eunice and Judy at the top of the escalators is definitely a bit that has stayed with me for a long time. At the recording of this, it has been about a week since Tropical Storm Eunice absolutely ravaged the British Isles. And when I first heard news reports that said that Eunice was battering the coasts and inlands of England, my immediate first thought was, Eunice? That's a person named Eunice? Which is exactly what Barbra Streisand's character says when she first encounters her in the hotel. There's almost no part of that scene that I don't find quotable, but the end where after she has revealed that she's calling Howard by the name Steve, that Howard knows her name, and that Eunice is just awash in a sea of feminine instability, she stomps off and Eunice calls after her, "Don't you know the meaning of the word propriety?" And in true Batman portable encyclopedia fashion, she then rattles off the Merriam-Webster dictionary definition of propriety as she's going down the escalator, stabbing her finger in the air just as she crests below the line of sight.
Don't you know the meaning of propriety?
Propriety? Noun. Conformity to established standards of behavior or manner, suitability, rightness, or justice. See etiquette.
It's the kind of pedantic victory moment that every crazy word nerd has ever dreamed of.
Marry you.
Yep. Yep, 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 yep.
Yeah, it's a very effective scene.
And, yeah. I was going to talk about Bogdanovich talking about it on the commentary, but I'm not going to dignify him by giving him any more time. So.
Yeah, he sounds like kind of a loser.
He's very well loved. He was a film buff who went out there and interviewed filmmakers, and they invited him to be a filmmaker himself, and he won. And then he slept with actresses. Like, he's he did what most fanboys hope to replicate now.
Oh.
It's not great, but he is the fantasy of turning your fandom into being part of the scene. And I think that that has a powerful influence on his reputation. He's also made some stone cold bangers of movies. He's also made a bunch of flops, and his personal life has been an unmitigated wreck for most of his life. He is a polarizing figure when you dig into him. But if you skate off the surface, he seems great. And so it's easy for people to put him up on a pedestal if they don't look too deeply.
Okay, fair enough.
What do you have as a favorite moment?
Well, I have a few. When you were talking, it reminded me of like one sort of similar to the one that you were mentioning really close to the beginning, where Judy meets Howard for the first time.
Mm.
It was really surprising, which is why it stands out to me. And Howard is like almost mansplaining to her about what he studies.
This is in the drugstore when he's got the tuning fork up to the piece of Alcatraz.
Yeah, and he's saying, I study metamorphic rocks. And then he says, but I guess you wouldn't really know anything about that. And she says, oh, no, I'm, you know, I'm more interested in like sedimentary or igneous. Or, no, he's saying, I study igneous rocks. And she's saying, no, I'm more interested in metamorphic or sedimentary rocks. And then the bit goes even further. And then she goes into like, you know, your feldspars, your quartz, your...
I relate primarily to micas, quartz, feldspar. You can keep your pyroxenes, magnetites, and coarse grained plutonics as far as I'm concerned.
Sort of like you were saying before with the other scene, like it just has like layers and layers where the script just like drops down into its complexity. And that part of Judy's character, I really like. The intensity of her intelligence. It's not just like a little smart, right? They didn't just go with like, metamorphic and sedimentary. They couldn't just like leave that joke there alone. They had to like keep going.
Right. I mean, most people could probably name the four different types of rocks. I think there are four. I might be wrong.
I thought there were only three. I don't know. We gotta look it up and put it in the show notes.
Or we can cut all this out. But yeah, to then have somebody have looked up a bunch of rocks in the Encyclopedia Britannica and then give that knowledge to her.
Yeah.
It makes her a wunderkind.
And it's a better joke. And that's part of what I really liked about it, is that it wasn't just like a little bit of a joke. It was a lot of bit of a joke. And
it's a lot of a joke.
Yeah. And that's what I would have liked to see more of between the two characters. But aside of me criticizing this movie even more, I'll say that I really liked that that was like how the two characters met and what they did with that moment.
While we're talking about Judy as a character, let's talk about one of the showstopper moments of the movie, which happens right after the halfway point, when Howard's been kicked out of the hotel, but because of a weird glitch from Judy's jinx factor, ends up on the top floor instead of going down to the lobby, where he finds her asleep on the piano. And you have Barbara Streisand singing in full Barbara Streisand voice as time goes by from Casablanca.
A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh.
The moment is incredible, in my opinion, as it shows how powerful she is as a musician and a performer. And that's not anything I really understood. When I was growing up, Barbara Streisand was for other people. She was a musician that, for whatever reason, I was just like, nope, that's something other people like. It's show tunes, it's queer, it's all these things. It wasn't a thing that I ever gave a chance. And so to hear her voice in this movie and to see her sing very clearly without a backing track, and to have the full round power of the notes that she's producing inches away from Ryan O'Neill's head, every time I'm amazed and awed by just how good of a musician she is and how clearly deserved she was of being a massively successful, internationally powerful singer in the quiet, tiny intimacy of that scene that she blows out at the stops on.
Yeah. She's very talented. This is me not yucking your yum. That's all I'm going to say.
No, go ahead and disagree.
No, I think that she's very talented. That's just not what I took away from that scene.
You couldn't not see the romantic problems with that.
Yeah, that was like another point. It was like, you say, like, it was like, what, 50 minutes into the movie, and she's still launching herself at him. She's unwanted. You know, he's still resisting.
Well, that's really the switch. That's the scene where it goes the other way, because when he gets the letter and he celebrates, he instinctively kisses her. And that's supposed to, in the world of the script, show that that's what he wanted all along. And then you have the very problematic transition of him saying, I should tell Eunice this first. And then she kisses him and he says, or at least second. And then she kisses him more and she says, what about Eunice? And he says, who's Eunice? Effectively, therefore, denying her for the second time because of the raw power of her sexuality.
I can't even.
Absent the characters, I'm always knocked out by Streisand's performance.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with Judy.
Yeah.
What do you got next?
I think that something that I wasn't expecting to see was the car chase scene, which has a number of elements. I'm trying to like pick out what, like which parts of it to talk about, but and you mentioned earlier that this part with the glass stayed with you like for your whole life, and that's, you know, like, I feel like we could talk about that for like half of the episode, because it is so striking, and it's the tension that gets introduced when you see these two workers like walk out with this huge plate of glass at the bottom of this huge hill. It's right when Judy and Howard's character are at the top of the hill on the bicycle, like the little delivery cart. So like, so, you know, Chekhov's gun that gets introduced. It's like, okay, so you know that the glass needs to break before the scene is done, but you don't, but you don't know how.
And the fact that it goes through basically every permutation of it not being broken.
It's brilliant.
They're going one way and the car heads towards them and they shuffle back and then the next car and then the next car, and they survive and they get it off the street, and then the cars are coming back down the hill the other way. So no, wait, we still haven't escaped. We've got it. And then the bike goes past and then the next car and then the next car and then the next car, and they all miss the pane of glass.
And then
the last car hits the ladder, and so it's the guy on the banner who breaks the pane of glass.
And there's another wonderful part of this scene is this huge A-frame ladder. This guy who's been hanging up this banner across the street, and he, of course, like all of the like the little clips pop off the banner, and he like swings down off the banner and smashes into the pane of glass. It's incredibly satisfying, the way the good slapstick should be.
But the fact that they delayed it and delayed it and delayed it, like, as you say, the Chekhov's gun nature of it is the second they introduce the glass, you know that glass has to break. But they actually keep on teasing away from you that that car didn't do it, and that car didn't, and they even had three cars, so they rules of threed it to you. And it didn't happen the first time round, and it only happens the last time because of apparently what's called the topper. In comedic circles, Buck Henry and Bogdanovich talked about the fact that the best way to do a joke is to do the three iterations and then have the fourth thing be the thing that makes the joke even funnier. And so it's the third car that hits the ladder that causes the glass to break is a perfect execution of the rule of three plus the topper that gets it to happen.
I learned something today. Rule of three plus one.
I've talked about Madeline Kahn's, the unfortunate misogyny towards Madeline Kahn in this, and we've debated about whether or not she's a realistic person, and therefore whether or not the things that are done against her can be perceived of as funny or tragic. And I want to bring up a specific part of the film that I think allows her to play some pitch-perfect comic bits. And that's when she is sent by Judy to the wrong address.
Oh my God.
And ends up in a creepy warehouse on the pier where the bad guys don't have the jewels, but they've got Howard's rocks instead. And first of all, when she gets out of the cab and the cabbie's like, "You don't want me to stick around, do you, lady?" And she's like, "Yes, yes, please." He's like, "Great, I didn't think so." And his car peeling off is what reveals where she is. Like, two shots of them has been in close-up, and so we didn't see the background. And then as the car exits in front of the camera, it shows the dilapidated, terrifying shack and the emptiness and, like, just how wrong this is. Like, she shouldn't have gotten out of the cab.
Yeah, totally.
And then she climbs the most rickety staircase in the world, all the while saying, is this the Larrabee Foundation? No! No, Eunice, it's not the Larrabee Foundation. There's nothing Larrabee Foundation about this building that you're walking into with peeling paint and stained curtains and no doorknobs.
Hello? 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 Hello?
And then she's making these little mewling noises the whole time. These little desperate scare. And it's just such a good performance. It's so, she's so good. There's nothing real about it. And yet her tiny noises and her weirdness. And then when she goes from "I'm scared and out of place" to "Those are Howard Bannister's rocks. What are you..." Like, she goes into mother lion mode over her fiancé's bag of rocks. She's so good. She deserved... This was her first film role.
Oh, really?
She gets the "and introducing" credit in the opening credits in the book. There are plenty of Madeleine Kahn roles where I haven't been on the same wavelength as her performance. Young Frankenstein springs to mind. She doesn't work for me there. She definitely doesn't work for me in Clue, but almost nothing works for me in Clue. I'm one of the few people who in the world who doesn't find that movie remotely funny.
Never seen it.
Yeah, well, everybody else says you should. I disagree. Come at me, podcast audience. Yeah, she deserves every role she got. She deserves everything based on this role. She's so good and so funny. And her performance is why I understand why you can't forgive Judy and Howard. Because even while I think she's being cartoonish, even while I think she's being deliciously over the top, she brings a particularness to it that makes me understand why somebody else would say she's too real to allow someone to hurt her. And I would be protective of that character too.
It's not really like sympathy for her that makes me feel the way that I do.
Aggravation that anybody would treat anyone that way.
Or it's like an aversion to Judy's character, I think. And the way that she acts.
The way in which she walks into a room and says, "I get whatever I want now."
Yeah, like very selfishly and without interest in the consequence to others. But I thought that Eunice's character was amazing. And I thought that for, in terms of like running visual gags, her wig probably like made the movie for me. Especially because she has beautiful hair. Like beautiful hair. And so her sort of like trying to like yank on her wig to like go out the door to like greet someone. So it was like a sort of like prop on top of her head, like in this really like like ill-fitting, yeah, unflattering way. It's just like, it's an amazing visual gag. It's amazing. It was one of my favorites. I think part of the reason why it did not offend me as much as it could have, that the butt of the joke was that she was unattractive is because she is beautiful. And so that almost didn't hit as hard as it could have in terms of the misogyny. But I think other parts of that did not work for me, as we have covered, as we have amply discussed. But Madeline Kahn, I think, was a treasure.
Which is a great phrase, considering that that's what everybody in the movie says about Judy. But we're reclaiming it.
They said that Judy's a treasure?
Yeah, you've got Larrabee at the table being like, she's a gem, Bannister, a gem. And you're like, no, Madeline Kahn is more than a gem. She's a whole treasure.
A treasure chest. Yeah, I stand by that.
Farced Perspective was created and developed by Ben Russell and Nathan Emily. This episode was researched, recorded, and produced by the presenters. Editing by Ben Russell. Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song was mixed from recordings of Silver and Cone's Yes, We Have No Bananas, sourced by Creative Commons clips from the archive.org community. You can find us at farceperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at farcenamebasis. If there are things, facts, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website, and we will post it to our errata page on Farce Perspective as soon as possible. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of comic phenomenon, and our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Ben, my co-host is Anna, and we'll see you next time when we discuss another comic touchstone celebrating a key anniversary.